Did you have any contact with, I don't know what to call Strauss, so I point, this tenant? No, he says, never. Did anyone ever call him by a name? No. I mean, we're trained to call our tenants by their last name, you know, Mr. or Mrs. or Doctor or whatever. If we don't know the name, we use Sir or Ma'am. But with him, I mean, I never even saw the guy, and I've been here 2 years.
I turn my attention back to the screen. Hit play, please.
He does.
The video is short and uneventful. Strauss and assailant walk with their heads down, single file, staying close together. It looks odd. I ask him to rewind and play it again. Then a third time.
Hit pause when I tell you.
Okay, sure.
Now.
The image freezes. I squint and lean closer. I still can't pick up much, but this much seems clear. Both knew that they were on a security camera, and at this point, the point where I've asked the image to be frozen, the man we now know is Ry Strauss, looks up into the lens.
Can you zoom in?
Not really, no. The pixels get all messed up.
I doubt that I would pick up much anyway. The assumption, and I think it is a righteous one, is that the bald man behind Ry Strauss is the killer. Their manner is so off, stiff, short steps, staying so close, that I assume Strauss is being led by gunpoint.
To your knowledge, did the deceased ever have visitors?
Nope, never. We all talked about that this morning.
We?
Me and the other doorman. No one remembers anyone coming to see him, not ever. I mean, I guess they could have come with him up through the basement like this.
I assume this visitor eventually left?
If he did, we don't have it on tape.
I sit back and steeple my fingers.
We done?
The doorman asks. How about the footage of the tenant departing the building?
Huh?
I point at the screen. Before he met up with this visitor, I assume the deceased left the building?
Oh, right, yeah.
Could you show me?
Give me a second.
This video is even less eventful. Ry Strauss keeps his head down. He wears the hoodie. He walks by, though I do note that he seems in a rush. I check the time. 42 minutes before he returns. This all adds up in my view.
You said he never left in the daytime, correct?
Not that anyone remembers.
So this, I point to Strauss walking out during the daytime, would be unusual.
I'd say, yeah. Hermit normally only went out like super late at night.
That piques my interest. How late?
You'd have to ask Hormuz. He works the night shift, but really late, way after midnight.
Will Hormuz be on tonight?
Yeah. Whoa, someone is coming with packages. Excuse me a moment.
The young doorman departs. I take out my phone and call PT. Did your guys find a phone in Strauss's apartment, I ask?
No.
No landline either?
No. Why?
I have a theory, I tell him.
Go ahead.
Someone called Strauss on a phone and told him something worrying. Perhaps that his cover was blown. We can only speculate. But someone called him and told him something so worrying that the hermit left his apartment during daylight hours. My suspicion is it was a setup.
How do you figure?
The killer placed the call to Strauss and said something on the phone they knew would get Strauss to react. When Strauss leaves the building, the killer intercepts him at gunpoint and forces Strauss to bring him back to his apartment.
Where the killer shackles him to the bed and kills him.
Yes.
And leaves the Vermeer behind. Why?
The obvious answer, I say, is that his murder wasn't about the stolen art.
So what else would it be about?
It could be a lot of things. But I think we know the most obvious one.
The Hut of Horrors,
he says. We are silent for a while.
The Bureau hasn't put that part together yet, Wynn.
I say nothing.
They still don't know why your suitcase is there. When they do, they'll want alibis for your cousin, and for you.
I nod to myself. His is a solid analysis. It seems likely, I say, that Ry Strauss was involved in some way with the Hut of Horrors. His voice is grave.
It does.
I feel a chill at the base of my neck. So I'm wondering.
Wondering what?
Everyone has always believed that Uncle Aldrich and Cousin Patricia were random victims of serial predators. Uncle Aldrich was killed so as to abscond with Patricia to the hut.
You don't think so anymore?
I frown. Think it through, P.T. It can't be random.
Why not?
Because Strauss had the Vermeer. He takes a second.
You're right. That can't be a coincidence.
And that means Patricia wasn't a random victim. She was targeted. We fall into silence.
Let me know how I can help, Wynne.
I assume the Bureau will be analyzing these CCTV videos?
We are, but the quality is crap, and this has been a pain in my ass for years. Why the hell do we keep all the cameras up high? Every criminal knows that. He just kept his head down.
So nothing else on him?
They're still analyzing, but all they can tell us is he's slight, short, bald.
It's more important that you scour the nearby buildings for CCTV, I tell him. We need to figure out where Strauss went when he left the Beresford and who he encountered.
On it. Where are you going now?
I check my watch. Enough work for the moment. My mind shifts quickly to the 9.85 rating. Saks Fifth Avenue, I say. I am nearing Saks when the phone rings. It's Nigel calling from Lockwood.
Your father heard about the Vermeer, Nigel tells me. He also heard that Cousin Patricia was in the house.
I wait.
He would like to see you. He says it's urgent.
I push the door open and enter Saks by the men's suits department.
Urgent as in tonight? Urgent as in tomorrow morning.
Done, I say.
One favor, Wynne.
Name it.
Don't upset your father.
Okay, I say. Then I ask, how is he, Nigel?
Your father is very agitated.
Over the Vermeer or Cousin Patricia?
Yes,
Nigel says, and hangs up. I head into the basement of Saks and pass the vault jewelry department. The rendezvous app has a rather lengthy questionnaire to discover your type in order to make the best matches. I skipped answering the questions and went straight to the comments section. What's my type? I wrote one word, hot. That's my type. I don't care whether she's blonde, brunette, redhead, or bald. I don't care whether she's short or tall, heavy-set or emaciated, white, black, Asian, young, old, whatever. My type. I use one type of criteria and rank them thusly. Super, super hot? Super hot. Hot. More hot than not. That's it. The rest, as I say, does not matter. I hold no prejudices or biases when it comes to hotness. And yet I ask you, where are my laurels for being so open-minded? I'm first to arrive in the suite. The app tells me that my rendezvous partner is still 15 minutes away. The shower is supplied with Kevis 8 shampoo and Maison Francis Kirkdigian Aqua Vitae scented shower cream. I take advantage of that. I strip down and close my eyes under the heavy stream of the propulsive power jet Speakman showerhead. I think chronologically for a moment. We have the Jane Street 6 attack. We have the art heist at Haverford College. We have my uncle's murder and my cousin's abduction. 3 different nights. The first 2 are connected by the Vermeer found in the possession of the most famous of the Jane Street 6. Then we add in the suitcase, and it becomes apparent that all 3 are somehow linked. How? Most obvious answer, by Rye Strauss. We know Strauss was leader of the Jane Street 6. We know he was in possession of the stolen Vermeer. Where is the Picasso, by the way? We know that the suitcase, last seen when Patricia was abducted, was in his tower apartment. Was he the mastermind behind all 3? I get out of the shower. Ms. 9.85 rating should be here within minutes. I am about to silence my phone when Kabir calls. I found the security guard from the art heist.
Go on.
At the time of the robbery, he was an intern paying off student debts by working security at night. I remember this. One of the criticisms leveled at both the college and our family was that we had trusted two priceless masterpieces to shoddy security. It was a criticism, of course, that proved spot on. His name is Ian Cornwell. He'd only graduated from Haverford the year before. Where is he now? Still at Haverford. In fact, he's never left. Ian Cornwell is a professor in the political science department. Find out if he's on campus tomorrow. Also, get a copter ready. I'm flying to Lockwood first thing in the morning. Got it. Anything else? I need some information about Malachy's. I start telling him what I need when I hear the elevator ping. The 9.85 rating has arrived. I finish up quickly and say, no calls for the next hour. Then, thinking about that rating, I add, perhaps the next two or three. I disconnect the phone as she steps out of the elevator. I had assumed the rating would be an exaggeration. It isn't. She has always been and remains now at least a 9.85. For a moment, we just stare at one another. I'm in my robe. She is in a crisply tailored business suit, but everything she wears always looks crisply tailored. I try to remember the last time I saw her in the flesh, when she and Myron ended their engagement, I gather, but I can't recall the specifics. Myron had loved her with all his heart. She had shattered that heart into a million pieces. Part of me found the whole thing incomprehensible and tedious, this broken-hearted thing. Part of me understood with absolute clarity why I would never let any woman leave me in that way. Hello, Wynne.
Hello, Jessica.
Jessica Culver is a fairly well-known novelist. After a decade together, she and Myron broke up because in the end, Myron wanted to settle down, marry, have children, and Jessica sneered at that sort of idyllic conformity. At least, that was what she'd told Myron. Not long after the breakup, Myron and I saw a wedding announcement in the New York Times. Jessica Culver had married a Wall Street tycoon named Stone Norman. I hadn't seen, heard, or thought about her since.
This is a surprise, I say.
Yep. Guess it isn't going so great with you and Rock.
Immature of me to intentionally get the name wrong, but there you go.
Jessica smiles. The smile is dazzling and beautiful, but it doesn't reach more than my eyes. I remember when that same smile used to knock poor Myron to his knees.
It's good to see you, Wynne.
I tilt my head.
Is it?
Sure. We stand there for a few moments. So, are we going to do this or what?
Chapter 11. The answer ends up being what? Jessica and I spend the next hour lying on the bed and talking. Don't ask me why, but I end up telling her about Rye Strauss and the Vermeer and the rest. She watches me closely as I speak, completely rapt. As I said, I don't get romantic relationships. During the years that Jessica and Myron were a couple, I understood that she was very attractive and immensely doable, but so are a lot of women. I never got why Myron would want only one woman or put up with her mood swings and drama. Now, as she lies alongside me and gives me that laser focus, I perhaps get a tiny sliver of the appeal. I stop and tell her this.
You hated me, Jessica says.
No,
you viewed us as rivals.
You and I?
Yes.
For?
For Myron, of course.
Jessica shifts on the bed. She is still clothed. I remain in my bathrobe.
You know, I wrote a piece on the Jane Street Six for the New Yorker.
When?
It was one of the anniversaries of the attack. 20, maybe 25th, I don't remember. You can probably find it online. She tucked her hair behind her ear. It's pretty fascinating stuff. How so? It's a perfect storm of what-if tragedy. The Six had originally planned to hit another USO dance hall a month earlier, but Strauss had come down with appendicitis. What if he hadn't? Several of the Six were getting cold feet and threatened not to show. What if one or two had backed out? They were just stoned kids wanting to do some good. They didn't set out to hurt anyone. So what if? What if that one Molotov cocktail hadn't gone astray? I'm not impressed with this analysis. Everything in life is a what if. True. Can I ask a question? I wait. Why isn't Myron helping you? I mean, all the times you played Watson to Sherlock, he's busy. With his new wife. I don't feel right talking about Myron with her. Jessica sits up. You said you need to watch the documentary on the Jane Street Six.
I do.
Let's watch it together and see what happens. Jessica lies on the right side of the bed. I take the left. Our bodies are close together. I prop up the laptop between us. She puts on reading glasses and flips off the lamp. I click the play button. We start watching the documentary in surprisingly comfortable silence. I find this whole experience odd. For me, Jessica was just an annoying and inconvenient extension of Myron, never her own being. To see or experience her with no attachment to him feels somehow uneasy, not in spite of the comfort, but because of it. For the first time, I am seeing her as her own entity, not just Myron's hot girlfriend. I'm not sure how I feel about that. The documentary begins by pointing out that the group was never called the Jane Street Six. They were just six seemingly random college students, a ragtag splinter quasi-group from the Weather Underground, or Students for a Democratic Society. The nickname Jane Street Six was given to them by the media after that disastrous night for the very simple reason that the famed photograph of the six of them had been taken in the basement of a townhouse on Jane Street in Greenwich Village. It was down in the dark dwelling, the serious narrator informed us, that they brewed the most deadly cocktail of all, the Molotov cocktail. Dum, dum, dum. The narrative then went back in time to how Ry Strauss and Arlo Sugarman originally bonded as sixth graders in the Greenpoint section of Brooklyn. They flashed up an old black-and-white classic team photo of Ry and Arlo on a Little League team, half-standing, half-kneeling, dramatically using red marker to circle the two young faces on the far right. Even then, Mr. Voiceover gravely intoned, Strauss and Sugarman stood side by side. The documentary mercifully skipped those poorly acted and poorly lit reenactment scenes, the ones you always see on true crime drama. They stuck to real footage and interviews with local police, with witnesses, with survivors from the bus crash, with families and friends. A tourist had snapped a photograph of Ry Strauss and Lake Davies running away. The photo was blurry, but you can see them holding hands. The rest were behind them, but you couldn't make out any faces. The documentary did a bit on the seven victims: Craig Abel, Andrew Dressler, Frederick Hogan, Vivian Martina, Bastian Paul, Sophia Staunch, Alexander Woods. Jessica says, "Remind me to tell you about Sophia Staunch when we're done." The documentary focused in on five teenage boys from St. Ignatius Prep who had gone to New York that fateful night to celebrate the 17th birthday of Daryl Lance. Back in those days, bars and clubs were not strict about proof of age, and the drinking age had only been 18 anyway. It came out later that the boys had gone to a strip club with the subtle moniker 69 before hopping on the late-night bus heading back out to Garden City. Daryl Lance, who had been in his mid-40s when they filmed the documentary, spoke about the incident. He'd only suffered a broken arm, but his friend Frederick Hogan, also age 17, died in the crash.
Lance welled up when he described the flames, the panic, the bus driver's overreaction. I could see the driver turn the wheel too hard. We went up on just two wheels. I could see the bus start to careen out of control and head for that stone wall. And then we plunge off the road, almost in slow motion. Then they replayed the press conference, where Vanessa Hogan absolved the six. I forgive them totally because it's not my place to judge, only God's. Perhaps this was God's way for Frederick to pay for his own sin. I turned slightly toward Jessica. Is she saying God executed her son for going to a strip club? Apparently, she says. I interviewed her for my story. The doc moves on to Billy Rowan's surprise visit to Vanessa Hogan. On the screen, an older Vanessa Hogan spoke to the documentarian about it. We sat right here, right at this very kitchen table. I asked Billy if he wanted a Coke. He said yes. He drank it so fast. What did you talk about? Billy said it was an accident. He said they didn't mean to hurt anyone, that they only wanted to make a statement against the war. What did you think of this? I kept thinking how young Billy was. Frederick was 17. This boy was only a few years older. What else did Billy Rowan say? He saw me on the television. He said he wanted to hear me forgive him with his own ears. Did you? Yes, of course. That couldn't have been easy. The path isn't supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be righteous. Jessica looks at me. Good line.
Indeed.
She used it on me, too.
But?
Jessica shrugs. It sounded too rehearsed. Back on the screen, Vanessa Hogan says, I tried convincing Billy to surrender,
But?
He was so scared. His face. Even now, I think about Billy Rowan's scared face. He just ran out my kitchen door. I whisper, she's kind of hot.
Ew. You don't think so?
You haven't changed, Wynn, have you? I smile and shrug. What was your take when you met her?
Two words, Jessica says. Batshit crazy. Because she's religious?
Because she's a nut and a liar.
You don't think Billy Rowan visited her?
No, he did. A lot of evidence proves it.
So?
I don't know. Vanessa Hogan's reactions were just all off. I get the belief that your son has gone to a better place or that it's God's will, but there were no tears, no mourning. It was almost as though she expected it, like it wasn't a surprise.
We all grieve in different ways, I say.
Yeah, thanks for offering up the comforting cliché, Wynn. But that's not it. Jessica rolls on her side to face me. I do the same. Our lips are inches apart. She smells incredibly good. Sophia Staunch, she says. Another Jane Street 6 victim. What about her? Her uncle was Nero Staunch. Nero Staunch was a huge name in organized crime back in the day. I roll on my back and put my hands behind my head.
Interesting, I say.
How so?
Lake Davies not only changed her name, but she changed her entire identity and moved to West Virginia. I asked her if she did that because she was afraid Rye Strauss would find her.
What did she say?
Her exact words were, not just Rye.
So she was afraid of someone else,
Jessica says.
And who better than Nero Staunch?
When we finish the documentary, Jessica asks to see my list of people to question. I show it to her. We add Vanessa Hogan. Why not? She was the last person to see Billy Rowan.
Is Nero Staunch still alive? She asks me. I nod. He's 92. So out of the game.
You're never really out of that game, but yes.
I add his name to the list, too. We are still in the bed.
Jessica meets my gaze and holds it.
Are we going to do this, Wynn?
I move to kiss her, but I stop. She smiles.
Can't, huh?
It's not that, I say. I don't quite understand what I am feeling, and that annoys me. Jessica and Myron have been over for a long time. He's happily married to another woman. She is mind-bendingly beautiful, super, super hot, and willing. Jessica then reads my next thought and says it out loud. If sex is such a casual thing to you, why can't you? I don't reply. She rolls out of bed.
Maybe you should think about that, she says.
No need.
Oh?
I still think of you as Myron's girl. She smiles at that.
Is that it?
Yes.
Nothing more?
Like? I don't know, like something more... Jessica looks up, fake searching for the word latent. Oh, please, could you be more obvious? One of us couldn't be. Come back to the bed, I say. Let me convince you otherwise. But she is already heading to the elevator.
It really was good to see you, Wynn. I mean that.
And then she's gone.
Chapter 12.
I get back to the Beresford at 1 a.m. Hormuz spots me coming to the door. He hurries to open it. I flash a fake FBI identification and stick it back in my coat pocket. I realize that impersonating an officer is breaking the law, but here is the thing about being rich. You don't go to jail for crimes like this. The rich hire a bunch of attorneys who will twist reality in 1,000 different ways until reality is made irrelevant. They'd claim Hormuz is a liar. They'd say I was obviously joking. They'd deny I ever flashed anything at all. Or, if we are on tape, they'd say I flashed a photograph of someone I was visiting. We would whisper quietly in the ears of friendly politicians, judges, prosecutors. We would make donations to their campaigns or their pet causes. It would go away. If, by some miracle, it didn't go away, if by some 1 in 1,000 chance the authorities were called in on this and stood up to the pressure and took it to trial and found a jury to convict me of impersonating an officer, the punishment would never be prison time. Rich guys like me don't go to prison. We, gasp, pay fines. Since I have a ton of money already, 100 times more than I could spend in a lifetime at the very least, why would that deter me? Am I being too honest? A similar calculation is made in my business all the time. It is why so many choose to bend the rules, break the rules, cheat. The odds of getting caught? Slim. The odds of being prosecuted? Slimmer. If you do somehow get caught, the odds of simply paying a fine that will be lower than the amount of money you stole? Great. The odds of doing any kind of real prison time? A mathematical formula constantly approaching zero. I detest that. I don't stand for cheaters or thieves, especially those who aren't doing it to feed a starving family. Yet, here I am with my fake ID. Do I appear the hypocrite?
Yeah, Hermit was like a vampire, Hormuz tells me. Only came out at night, I guess.
Hormuz has eyes so heavily lidded, I don't get how he sees anything. He has a bowling ball paunch and one of those dark faces that appear to be 5 o'clock shadowed seconds after a shave.
You want something to drink? He asks me. Coffee?
Hormuz shows me his mug, which probably began life as something in the White family, but is now stained the color of a smoker's teeth. No, I'm good. I understand the mystery tenant used the basement exit.
Yep, which was weird.
Why weird?
Because he'd come out over there to the left. Then he'd circle in front of the building anyway. He'd walk right past me.
So he took more steps this way?
More steps, longer elevator ride,